The Energy Policy Committee will come to order. We don't yet have a quorum, but we're doing informational overviews. So once we have a quorum, we'll say that, and then we will move to approve the minutes at the end of the hearing. We do have a quorum. Members, today we're going to continue with informational overviews. I know it's most fun and exciting in committee when we have bills in front of us, but we will do better work if we have some good basic information first. And since what we do in this committee is regulate certain companies that provide energy in Minnesota, I thought it would make sense to hear from those entities. This is the same format that the committee followed in 2007. And when I listened to the tape of those hearings, I found it was really valuable to learn a little bit about the profile of the energy providers in Minnesota. So in continuing on that effort, Rick Evans is here from Xcel Energy. And if you will go ahead and identify yourself for the tape, and then go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Evans. I'm the Director of Minnesota Government Affairs for Xcel Energy. You have some handouts, I hope, in your packet that I'm just going to go through quickly, and I'll try to make this as fun and exciting as a bill, but we'll probably fail. The first thing, just to give you some idea, of who we are, is our Minnesota profile. Perhaps I should mention at the outset, Xcel Energy is a holding company that actually owns four public utilities. They are NSP Minnesota, which serves in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. NSP Wisconsin, which serves in Wisconsin and a little bit of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Southwest Public Service, which serves in the Texas Panhandle and southeastern New Mexico. And who am I missing? Oh, Public Service of Colorado, which serves in the Denver area in Colorado. And but my responsibility and the only one of our companies that serves here in Minnesota is NSP Minnesota. You can see from our profile we have a large electric utility which serves about 46% of the people in the state. We have a smaller gas utility that serves 436,000 customers around the state. We employ over 5,000 people in the state of Minnesota in our gas and electric business, making us one of the state's larger employers. If you go down through the rest of that page, you know, it will tell you about the various generating facilities that we own. In addition to owning facilities, we also purchase energy through what we call power purchase agreements, or PPAs. And as you look down into the box in the middle of that page, you'll see our fuel source mix for 2012. The top numbers in the top box are our owned facilities, the ones that we are owners of. And then you'll see the next box where the power purchase agreements are outlined, and those are where another company, a different company, runs the generation facilities, and we purchase their power from them. And so the other thing to point out, I think, on this is on the back side of it, you will see a list of all of the communities that we serve across the state of Minnesota, designated which ones we serve. If it doesn't say anything after the name, then we provide them with electricity only. For those that we provide electricity and gas or gas only, those are designated in the initials after that. The second thing in your packet that we'd like to bring your attention to, and the chair asked us to provide this some of this information, is our compliance report for the Renewable Energy Standard. This was filed with the Public Utilities Commission, as you can see, and if you look back onto, I believe, about page 5 of that document, you'll get some idea of how we're doing in our progress toward the Renewable Energy Standard. Again, the Renewable Energy Standard is set as a percentage of retail sales. So in our case, our next benchmark is by 2012, we were to reach 18% of our retail sales through qualified renewable energy. And you can see on that we did reach that goal in 2012. One of the things I think that, you know, the committee should take put some attention to is up at the very top line there, and that is the amount of our retail sales. Our retail sales actually dropped from 2011 until 2012, And so if you think about the renewable energy standard as being a percentage of retail sales, there's obviously two sides to that equation. And the one side is how much renewable energy are we providing, and the other is what our sales are. And so as it happened in the case from 2011 to 2012, with our retail sales declining as they did, it became somewhat easier for us to reach a renewable energy standard. If our sales hopefully continue to grow in the future, then we will have to apply that percentage to a larger number. We do believe we're going to reach our goal of 30% of renewable energy by 2020. We feel like we're on track to do that now, and look forward to continuing to work in that direction. I think that this, you know, document, 8 or 9 pages, is worth reading for the committee, just to get an idea of how we track these things and what kind of progress we're making as we move towards our renewable energy standard. The next item in the packet is an executive summary of a report on our conservation improvement program. Like the other utilities, we're required to reach a 1.5% savings through our conservation programs. As we go forward, we've been able to achieve that level of savings, and we take some pride in the fact that our conservation program at Xcel Energy has been a very effective one, and one that has been a model across the country. If you look at the bottom of page 3 in that document, you get some idea of the amount of energy that we've been able to save through our conservation program, and some idea of how much it costs. And that's separated between our electric conservation programs and our gas conservation programs. One of the things that you'll find if you read this report is that we are looking forward to a time when it's going to be more difficult for us to reach this goal and possibly more expensive. That's due in large part to the fact that we're losing some of the tools we have in our toolbox. We have had a lot of programs in the past that promoted compact fluorescent light bulbs, for example, and we were able to take credit for the savings that resulted from our rebate programs that provided those light bulbs. As incandescent light bulbs become regulated by the federal government and made very difficult to get, we're not going to be able to take credit for getting people to switch from one to the other, because it will be a legal requirement. So it's just one example of the kind of thing that happens in our business. Same thing applies for more efficient appliances. As appliances just become more efficient and consumers start demanding them, and as regulation of appliance makes the inefficient appliances less available, it's harder for us to use rebates to get our customers to buy them and then take credit for the conservation. So that's perhaps good news from the point of view of conservation, as consumers are moving towards more efficient appliances and light bulbs and other electric devices. But it's going to present a challenge for us with a standard of 1.5% reduction through conservation practices going forward, as we lose some of those tools in the toolbox. The next document in the packet there's no data on this, but it describes the carbon dioxide emission reporting that we do each year. There's a website at the bottom of the page which you can go look at and see more of the actual data of what we've been able to accomplish. We have currently the Next Generation Energy Act sets the goal of reducing carbon emissions based on 2005 levels. And you can, if you go on that website, you'll see that we've achieved a 12.8% reduction in CO2 emissions since 2005. That's a current number. The Next Generation Energy Act calls for a 15% reduction by 2015. So we are moving in that direction through a combination of shutting down fossil fuel plants and moving towards more renewable energy. As you may know, that those requirements in the Next Generation Energy Act are not mandates, but they are goals, and we've been working to achieve those. And if you look on the website that is at the bottom of that page, you can see how we're moving towards those in that direction. And then the last two pages that I wanted to show you, just because of, you know, sometimes a picture is worth a thousand words, and we need to kind of look at these together. The point that I wanted to make with these two graphs is that while we talk about our renewable energy standard in terms of 30% of our retail sales over the course of a year, putting renewable energy on the system does present challenges to us, and this graph sort of illustrates that. If you look at the way this is arranged, and it takes a little explaining, the graph shows hours of energy load, that is, how much we're selling to our customers over the course of each hour of a year. But it's not in chronological order. It starts with our heaviest load on the left-hand side of the page, and it moves to our lowest load on the right-hand side of the page. So it's put in the order of how much energy our customers are demanding for each hour of the day. And what it shows is, the reason I wanted to put it in the packet was, if you look at the green part of this, that's the wind. You can see that the wind is not very steady. It goes up and down, as we all know wind does, compared to, say, our nuclear plants at the bottom, which is the band of red that is really steady 24/7. They just run all the time. But the green moves up and down, and as you can see, it starts to move down into some of our other resources and presents a challenge in our ability to put the right amount of energy on the grid at any one time. It's not an insurmountable challenge. It's something that we take some pride in being able to manage. But if you look at the second one, you can't really see the date because it's sort of obscured on the way the slide was printed, but that's a 2020 projection. And as you can see in that, as we get to our 30% wind requirement, 30% renewable requirement with more wind on the system, that green line starts moving down into not only the coal resources, which are the blue line, but also in the low peak days down into the nuclear plants. And that presents a challenge for us because the nuclear plants and to a degree the coal plants can't be turned on and off as quickly as something like, for example, natural gas. So I bring this along only to illustrate that there's more to managing intermittent renewable energy on the grid than just getting 30%. It's also managing how that energy interacts with the other resources in our grid and the challenges that presents. We believe we're going to be up to the challenge. We believe we're going to be able to accomplish that, but it's important, I think, for policymakers as they're looking at particularly renewable energy policy to be aware of the complications that can arise. And so I thought these two graphs were sort of an interesting way for the committee to think about the variety of resources that we provide and some of the challenges that the renewable energy gives us in those resources. So that's really the end of what I had prepared, and I'd be happy to answer any questions on these topics or others.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm so glad you brought Mr. Evans here, particularly with these last two graphs. This is important work that this committee should consider in looking at the 2008 one. I was here then when we did a wind integration study, which seemed to indicate we could absorb about 10% wind with a little impact or little cost to the ratepayers or little impact to the performance of the generation fleet, and the 2008 chart seems to indicate that. So we promptly made it 30%, just because if 10's good, 30 must be better, somebody must have thought, and that's what this second chart represents. And I'm not going to ask Mr. Evans to respond to this unless he wants to, but I just know, because I'm friends with a couple of coal plant managers, when you start turning coal plants up and down, it monkeys with the efficiency of the plant, the cost of the power it's producing, and most importantly, with the emissions control equipment. Emissions control equipment is meant to be fine-tuned and then run full bore 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And look what happens here at 30% in 2020. We're turning coal plants off and on like they were a light switch on the wall. And I can't imagine what's going to happen to your emissions report. I'm looking forward to that discussion sometime in the future. Madam Chair, I did, though, have a question about conservation improvement plan numbers that Mr. Evans showed us on page 3 of that document. One of the things I know from some of our co-op and muni friends is the cost of kilowatt saved runs into the many dollars And I don't see on here, Mr. Evans, that you've given us a kilowatt cost. Do you know off the top of your head about how much a kilowatt hour is, how much we're spending to save a kilowatt hour, which at retail rate is, what, about 8 cents right now?
Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, I don't have that information. I can I could probably try to do the math here, but I wouldn't trust myself. I can get you that information, though, and provide that to the members of the committee.
I would add, too, we are going to have a whole hearing on conservation, okay. And I will be talking about cost-benefit analysis in that hearing. It's the 4th or 5th of February.
Madam Chair, outstanding. At that time, and I won't ask Mr. Evans to get the number right now, but this committee should consider what the mechanism is for adjusting the CIP. I know we set it at 1.5 here a couple years ago, and to my knowledge, in statute, we have no mechanism for adjusting it. That's pretty much up to us. And so as we make them chase their tail, it reminds me of the picture of the snake swallowing its tail. At 1.5% reduction every year, at some point, you're just going to disappear. And that would be really hard on our police and pension and teacher retirement funds, which are heavily invested in utility stocks. But when we get to that point, I'll be sure to ask that question again. Thanks.
And I will say that, Representative Beard, when I listened to the tapes in December of the wind integration study that was presented, I had very different takeaways from what you had.
Oh, good. Okay.
Mr. Evans.
I did want to make the point on the conservation that, you know, like with just about everything else we do, this is regulated by the Public Utilities Commission, and they do apply a cost-benefit standard to the measures that we take in conservation. So there is attention paid to whether or not the amount of money being expended is worth the amount of energy that's being saved, and that's something that, you know, as we go through each of our conservation plans, is heavily examined by the Public Utilities Commission.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, first of all, Madam Chair, I'd move approval of the minutes from the January 22nd meeting.
Representative Garofalo, did you read the minutes from the January 22nd?
Thoroughly.
All those in favor,
aye.
Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, and to Mr. Evans, regarding the SIP requirement and the renewable energy standard, what happens to Xcel if you don't meet those standards? Do we subject your business-to-business transactions to a sales tax? Do we tax your legal services? What's the penalty for Xcel if you don't meet those requirements or goals?
Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I guess I don't know. We've met them so far, so that's a good question. I'll find out. I think it's there's, as I recall, there's no penalty in the statute for not. I see Mr. Eloff looking, so maybe he can help me out here. But I don't believe there's a penalty in the statute for not meeting the requirements. Of course, the Public Utilities Commission, you know, has a certain amount of discretion over what we do, and that they may have an answer to that question.
Representative Garofalo.
That's correct. Good. Thank you.
What we'll do, if we can, one more and move on. We have about 15 minutes allocated for each of these presentations. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Evans, I know you have the small hydro. What is the general age of the small hydro facilities, and is there a concern that with filling in the reservoirs that capacity may be at risk in the near to moderate future?
Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, I don't know the answer to the age. I'll get that for you. I have not heard within the company of a concern that we would lose the small hydro. As you can see from the RES report, it's a relatively small portion of our renewable energy standard, and so I think there's probably not much concern about being able to replace it with other renewable energy resources, but I'll get an answer to that question for you.
Actually, I have two more questions for Mr. Evans, so if we can keep those brief, why don't we take them? Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at the 2008 and 2020 graphs that you gave us, there's some assumptions that I can see that the nuclear is, you like to run at a fairly constant load, and it looks like the same is nearly true of the coal-based production. It would be interesting to see these two graphs also put on a month-by-month basis. I understand it's not chronological this way, because there might be some opportunity to block out periods of time when the coal's taken offline You've got enough capacity to make up for it with the gas if you look at what's going on in the peak demand period, and that would alleviate the concerns about the emissions control and things like that. So it would be interesting to see what that graph looks like so we can see what the potential is there.
Mr. Evans.
I've not seen that graph, but I will look for it or see if we can maybe put one together in that along that line and show you that.
And Mr. Evans, wasn't there an article in this weekend's newspaper about some 1 megawatt battery you're trying out in Colorado?
Actually, that's in Minnesota. That's down in southwestern Minnesota. We have a 1 megawatt battery. If memory serves, it's able to discharge 1 megawatt for 9 hours when it's fully charged, and it's connected to a wind farm down there. It's been the reason the news story was there was because it's been shut off due to a fire danger that the manufacturer warned us about. But now that it's back up, and before we shut it off for the fire danger, we were trying to use the battery along with the wind energy to see if we could level out the to what degree we could level out the wind energy over time and provide a more predictable resource from the wind than what we have now.
Representative Hornstein, is it
very quick? Thanks, Madam Chair. You have the two RDF facilities in Red Wing and Mankato, but I didn't see one under your fuel source mix for 2012. I didn't see where that, under what category that those would be in.
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative Evans. Hornstein, those are classified as biomass plants.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. And members, please feel free to follow up with Mr. Evans offline. Joel Johnson, the Director of Government Affairs from Minnesota Rural Electric Association, is up next, and I think it might take a minute just to get his slide presentation loaded. And members, you have a copy of the slides in your packet. And with Mr. Johnson as well, we'll take some questions here, but then for questions that we don't have time for, please feel free to follow up with him directly after. And Mr. Johnson, will you introduce yourself for the tape and then go ahead?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Joel Johnson with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. Our organization represents the 44 distribution electric cooperatives in the state and the 6 G&Ts that supply them with power. We've had an opportunity to meet with most of you so far, so I'll kind of speed through this presentation. I think most of you have heard this. Just a little background on where we came from. When the grid was first being built, the municipal utilities and the investor-owned utilities did the math on running lines, electricity out to the farms, decided that they could not get a return on it, so it didn't happen. And during the New Deal, there was a push to electrify rural America, and so the farmers got together. They had help from the federal government, and the rural electric associations were born. As I mentioned before, there are 44 distribution co-ops located in the state. They range in size from just under 2,000 to more than 130,000. There are 6 generation and transmission cooperatives that provide them power. Those are owned by the distribution co-ops. Just a little background, too, we're private local electric companies, but we're owned by the customers that we serve. As I told the chair in our meeting with her, we are the grid democratized. When you're a co-op member, you get to vote on a member to the board to represent you. You also are provided opportunities for input during our annual meetings and attending any board meetings that you're interested in. We employ about 2,500 people in the state. These are good jobs in rural communities for the most part. Co-ops are good places to work. We serve 755,000 customer meters, and that translates to about 1.8 million Minnesotans. We serve, that's about 28% of the people in the state are served by co-ops. The medium-sized co-op is 6,472 members. We supply 14.5 billion kilowatts per hour. That's about 18% of the state's electric sales. We, as I mentioned before, we're nonprofit. We operate at close to cost. Our lenders require us to maintain a certain margin from year to year just to deal with the fluctuations in energy sales. and that not having to have a profit helps us provide competitive electric rates, particularly in rural areas of the state. Any revenues that go above our operating costs for a year are returned to our membership through what's called capital credits, and on the average, about $26 million a year is returned to electric cooperative members in Minnesota. We also do quite a bit of investing in our community and economic development. In 2011, Minnesota cooperatives guaranteed $2.39 million in no-interest loans. And these go to, you know, like the building of business parks in rural communities and to help attract. One of the other things that we do is most of the ethanol plants that are located within our system, during their early years of operation, they were provided lower rates to help them get on their feet. Some of the challenges we face are that we provide electricity for 85% of the geographic area of the state. And that translates to a lot more investment in capital to bring electricity out to our customers. Also, 41% of the net metered installations, those under 40 kW, are located on cooperative lines. That has been reduced dramatically. So even with that number, we still have 54% of the net metered capacity in the state. Our distribution network lines is the largest in the state by far. We have more distribution lines than all of the IOUs combined. We average 6.1 consumers per mile of line, compared with 38 consumers per mile of line for the IOUs and 48 customers per mile for the municipal electricities. Our revenue per mile of line is also significantly less than the others, $7,500. Compared to $68,000 for an investor-owned and $78,000. And that makes it harder to spread the investments in renewable energy and conservation across our membership. Also, 79% of co-op consumers have a per capita income below the state average, meaning that any changes in the electric rate impact our members significantly. We also serve a different customer base. 63% of our meters are residential, and we have relatively few large commercial and industrial. If you look at the chart on that next slide, the IOUs and for the munis, it's basically flipped on the number of electricity they sell. And that, again, impacts both our ability to meet the 1.5% conservation goal, and it also means that our daily demand curve is much steeper than it is for the other utilities, which means that we sell most of our electricity in a tighter band during the day. The 60 G&Ts serving Minnesota cooperatives are Great River Energy, they'll be presenting after me, Minn Kota Power, Basin Electric Power Co-op, Darylin Power Cooperative, East River Electric Power Co-op, and L&O Power Cooperative. Minn Kota serves 11 distribution cooperatives, 8 in northwestern Minnesota, 3 in eastern North Dakota. They're headquartered in Grand Forks. Their generation comes mostly through two coal facilities, the Milton R. Young Station near Center, North Dakota, and the Coyote Station. They provide about 60% of the G&T's electricity, or about 1,100 megawatts. 31% of their generation is wind currently, and then they get another 10% of their generation through the hydro from the Western Area Power Administration, which runs the dams on the Missouri River. Basin Electric serves 133 cooperatives in 9 states, and it provides power for 12 in Minnesota, but it is the exclusive provider for only 4. East River and L&O, the other two G&Ts, are actually members of Basin, purchase all of their electricity and then distribute it to their members. They're headquartered in Bismarck. Basin has 5,153 megawatts of capacity, 437 of that is wind, 44 is waste heat energy, and 69 kW flare gas. It also has 77 megawatts of purchased nuclear power. Dairyland Cooperative Power out of La Crosse, Wisconsin serves 25 cooperatives in four states and three in southeast Minnesota. It owns a little over 1,000 megawatts of coal generation, 22 of hydro, 71 of natural gas, and is contracted for 14 megawatts of landfill gas generation, 40 megawatts of biomass, 3 megawatts of methane manure digesters, and 47 megawatts of wind energy. And then it also has 143 megawatts that's contracted from the munis that it serves in addition to the cooperatives. I added the last two slides on this presentation mainly because things have really changed over the last decade in the way that we see utilities, in electric utilities in general. You know, the old view, I think, was that utilities simply provide electricity. You know, the G&T would generate and transmit the electricity to the distribution members. The distribution members, in turn, would deliver that utility to the customer. But, you know, over the course of this year, we're going to be discussing a lot of ways that are going to fundamentally change the way that electricity gets generated and distributed in the state, particularly when it comes to distributed generation. And some of the things that we need to make sure that in these changes is that we're not losing the things that we're already getting from our utilities. You know, first and foremost is safety. Almost half of the employees that work for my organization are dedicated to safety, of creating a safety culture at the co-ops and helping them deliver electricity safely. Once the responsibility for generating electricity, as Madam Chair said, becomes democratized, the responsibility for the safety also has to become democratized as well. The other thing we have is an accessible system. Regardless of where you live in the state, you have access to the grid. And as more and more people self-generate, that's going to be more and more difficult to maintain. We also have an affordable system so far. Pretty much everybody in the state can afford the electricity, and those who struggle with it have access to programs that help them further. You know, again, as more and more of our generation becomes distributed and individualized, we've got to take in consideration that we still have to make it affordable for all of the customers in the state. Reliability, again, this is something that could change. We take the job of providing reliable energy very seriously, and distributed generation provides challenges for that. Financing, insurance, technology and integration of the smart grid. There's a big move here, and right now the utility has to make sure that all of these things are working with their system. We do economic development. Again, this is something that co-ops take very seriously. We also have an on-demand system. When you want electricity, you get it, regardless of how much you need and what time of the day. And this, again, some of the changes that that are being proposed are going to have an impact on this. Energy storage, other things like that, energy exchange. But these are all questions that we need to keep in mind as we move forward and we discuss some of the changes that people are talking about. So with that, that's all I have. Great River Energy is also going to present, but I've answered any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. We're already about 8 minutes behind in the time we have allotted. So, Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, because this presentation touches on the distribution and net metering, at some time in the future, are we going to be able to cover that topic, maybe discuss the buy-all, sell-all, some of the other proposals, and maybe have the testifier return for, the industry input?
Oh, yes. Well, you know how the legislature works. We will consider issues that are brought to us in the form of bills. And at this point in the session, we don't have a lot of bills in front of us. I expect there will be bills on buy-all, sell-all, and distributed generation and solar. But to date, I'm not sure that anything's been authored and introduced into the hopper. I expect that we will be doing that, though. And when we talk about any issue in bill form where we're posed with the question of making a decision on policy, we will hear from both sides or all sides of an issue before we cast a vote. If you had a quick question on net metering or distributed generation you wanted to ask him, if he feels comfortable answering it, you can feel free.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have a analysis of the present impact, since you have such a large portion of the net metering, and the projected impact, especially with your tight margin, that you could share with the committee at a later date? I know we're short on time now.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Kwan, we actually have done quite a bit of work to determine what exactly this is costing in terms of costs that are shifted, particularly for the infrastructure costs, and we'd be delighted to share that with the committee.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and that was where my questions were related to that same topic, so we'll just hopefully hear from you in the future.
Any other questions for Mr. Johnson? Okay, if not, thank you very much, and we appreciate your availability to members outside of committee time also. Next, we have Gary Connett from Great River Energy. They have a headquarters up in Maple Grove, which is very near my home, and a new cupcake shop called Nadia's Cakes is right down the road. So last time when I went to see them, I made a stop there. All right, did I stall long enough to get your presentation set up?
I think you did.
Thank you, Mr. Connett. Please identify yourself for the tape and then proceed.
Madam Chair, my name is Gary Connett. I'm Director of Demand Side Management and Member Services for Great River Energy. I'll make this fairly quick, I think, because Joel went through a lot of what I might have said anyways. But to start, Great River Energy. Joel talked about MREA and the notion that there's 44 distribution co-ops in the state of Minnesota. Actually, Great River Energy serves 28 of those co-ops. In terms of sales, MREA, Joel mentioned, about 80% of MREA sales are through Great River Energy's distribution co-ops. In terms of members, Joel talked about MREA having somewhere around 780,000 members. We're about 650,000 of those members. 92% of our customers are residential. And another way of saying that might be better, and that is about 57 or 58% of our energy sales go to those residential customers. In terms of members per mile, what is that? A way that utilities often measure themselves against each other is how many members or customers do they have per mile of distribution line. And for many of the GRE member co-ops, it can be as less than 3 members per mile of distribution line. Very rural. Some investor-owned utilities might have as many as 10 or 15,000 customers per mile of distribution line. Very urban. 870 employees. You can see how much generation we have there. 4,600 miles of transmission. Transmission lines are slightly different than distribution lines. They're higher voltage. They're the ones that you see along the interstates and along the highways, the much larger transmission lines. This is a slide that was very similar to one that Joel showed. He showed the chart on the bottom. I'm going to just spend a couple minutes on it and just point out a couple things in terms of sales. And this is co-op sales in the state of Minnesota. What I wanted to point out is that residential sales for the distribution or for the distribution co-ops in Minnesota represent as many sales in terms of energy now as the investor owns. You look at the blue in the bottom of the slide there. We have nearly as many residential energy sales as the investor owns do. But what we don't have is we don't have those in industrial and commercial sales on top of that. Even the municipals, they sort of share their sales. A third to the residential, a third to the commercial, and a third to the industrial. For co-ops, we're different. Largely residential. And that comes into play when we start looking at programs, for example, conservation programs. When we're going to try to meet this conservation goal, we're going to do it on the backs of our residential consumers. We have to. We have to meet the conservation goal door to door, kilowatt hour by kilowatt hour. We're not going to make it in a large scale with a large industrial load. We don't have them. In terms of generation resources, this gives you a sense of who Great River Energy is in terms of our resources. Base load plants, every one of them that you see there is coal. The first three are in North Dakota. The last one, Juneau, is about 20 miles south of La Crosse, and we share that one with Dairyland Power. In terms of biomass, there was mention of a garbage. This is what we call a refuse-derived fuel. It's garbage that's been sorted once. and we take out the ferrous materials, we take out the glass, we take out as much plastics as we can, and the rest is considered burnable, and we burn it in a power plant in Elk River, Minnesota, refuse-derived fuel, or RDF we call it, and that's a biomass plant for us. In terms of peaking plants, we have 8 peaking plants in Minnesota. These are the plants that will come online on hot summer days or when the demand is high for electricity. I like to think of them as basically jet engines mounted to the ground. They're cheap to build, fairly expensive to operate. Of all those peaking plants that we have, all but 3 are natural gas fired, and we've got some small oil fired ones as well. I'll talk about the wind resources in just a minute. In terms of where those resources are located, in your package you've got a map that shows all the resources that I'm describing here this afternoon located on this map. The renewable energy standard, or the wind resources, where in terms of wind power, we have about 470 megawatts of wind energy in our portfolio. I should probably point out that we don't own any of that. The only wind turbine that we own is the one in the parking lot in Maple Grove, Minnesota. These are all contracts with developers and a long-term contract, anywhere from 15 to 18 to 20 years in length. We've got that biomass plant, that RDF plant that I mentioned in Elk River, that counts towards our renewable energy standard. We've got some Elk River landfill gas that we're collecting methane from and converting that methane into energy. And lastly, we have a dairy farms. It's one big family, and they like us not to share their name for some reason, but they're in Morris, Minnesota, and we are through an anaerobic digester process, get about 5 megawatts of generation, all counting towards our renewable energy standard. In terms of the renewable energy standard, we have sufficient renewable resources in place to meet this standard through the year 2024. And we do that with a strategy of banking the renewable energy credits. And those are the attributes that come from the kilowatt hours that are generated from wind or these biomass resources. It's an important concept to understand that these electrons have an attribute to them that other electrons don't. It's a green credit, if you will. A kilowatt hour is a kilowatt hour is a kilowatt hour. But if you create it from a renewable resource, it has this attribute, this green attribute, and you can trade or sell those attributes, if you will. And through a banking strategy that we have in place, we're going to meet the renewable energy standard till about the year 2024, based on our growth forecast. When we get to that year, we've got a boatload of wind energy to build. Somewhere around 800 megawatts of wind energy that we have yet to build to meet the renewable energy standard in the year 2025. But until then, because of the banking strategy that we have with these attributes, we're good until then. We have some concerns about the cost of wind energy versus current wholesale energy prices. We're sort of just getting used to that. The notion is that these contracts that we signed with these wind developers are somewhere in the range of 4.5 cents a kilowatt hour for 20 years. And the market, this what we call the MISO market, or the Midwest Independent System Operator, the price for energy in that market is somewhere on the average of less than 3 cents a kilowatt hour. And so we're buying this energy from the wind developers for 4.5, and you can buy energy in the market for about 3. And you know, they say you can't make that up on volume. Well, it's true. We're losing some money on that, but that's just the way it goes. Challenging to add new resources. I mentioned earlier that we have about 800 megawatts of renewable resources that we have to build to meet the 25 by 2025 rule. It's sort of challenging us to meet that new standard, if you will, when you don't have to build any resources at all. We're not growing. Rick mentioned how Xcel's not growing. Neither are we. And so we don't have any plans in our resource mix to install any new power plants in the next 27 years or so. But we will have to install somewhere around 800 megawatts of wind. Lastly, we're continuing to research end uses that are more compatible with wind energy. This may sound crazy, but get a load of this, and that is that a lot of our wind energy comes in the middle of the night. And it's not because it's windier at night than it is during the day, but Joel mentioned it. Our load curve goes into the tank in the middle of the night. We can't sell energy in the middle of the night because we're largely residential and we're all sleeping. And if the wind's blowing on those nights, we have a lot of wind energy that we don't know what to do with. And the notion is we need that big battery that Rick Evans spoke of. Another way to do this is with water heaters. We have large capacity electric water heaters in our service territory. We have 70,000 of them, and they're charged at night. They turn on at 11 o'clock at night, and they turn off about 7 in the morning. And in those hours, we heat enough hot water in those water heaters to meet all the requirements of that home the next day. We have by far the largest battery in the Midwest in 70,000 homes in rural Minnesota. And it's working very, very well. It's helping us to store wind energy that we have being produced in the middle of the night. I want to switch gears on you and talk about the CIP program, the Conservation Improvement Program. We, too, are meeting all the goals and the requirements in the law. And there was a question about, well, what exactly are the goals and requirements? I can tell you briefly. There's one goal, and that is we have to try to achieve 1.5% of our energy savings. For all the kilowatt hours that we sell in a year, we have to save 1.5% of that. That's a goal. The question was, is what if you don't meet the goal? Well, we don't know either. But it's a goal, and the way the Department of Energy Resources has told us is that we're not going to knock you over dead for not reaching the goal, but we want to see you making a good faith effort to reach that goal. And so we have been. But there's two other requirements in that law. One requirement, mandate, is you've got to spend 1.5% of your revenue. You've got to do that one. That's not a goal, that's a requirement. You've got to spend 1.5% of your revenue. And for Great River Energy, that's about $14 million. We've got to meet that spending requirement. There's a second spending requirement in the law as well. And this one's a little different. It has to do with low-income members, low-income customers. You've got to spend 0.2% of your residential retail revenue on low-income members. 0.2% of your residential retail revenue. For Great River Energy's co-ops, that means about $1.3 million we have to spend on low-income members. Two mandates and one goal in that CIP legislation. Cost per kilowatt hour saved. The way the state measures that is as they look at how much did you spend on your CIP programs in 2012? And how much energy did you save in that 1 year, 2012? And when we do the math, how much did you save versus how much you spent, it comes out to be about 15 cents per kilowatt hour saved. Here's the catch in that. The energy that we save doesn't just occur in 1 year. The energy that we save for all the efforts that we did in 2012 reoccur. The energy for that CFL, that energy for that high efficient air conditioner, they're reoccurring each and every year. And so you have a life of the measure savings as well. That's not in this calculation. This is saying for all the money we spent in 2012 and all the energy we saved in 2012, it cost us 15 cents per kilowatt hour. Excuse me. The question was, boy, are there programs that are far in excess of that? There can be. We can have programs that are far more than 15 cents, particularly with our low-income members. We have a hard time coming up with programs for low-income members. There's other programs that just don't cut mustard, and we have to cut them out of the portfolio. Excuse me. But on average, it's 15 cents per kilowatt hour. Keep this number in mind as you start looking at solar rebate programs. If you were to dig into a solar rebate program that Xcel had for 2 years, you might find that their cost per kilowatt hour saved was far in excess of 15 cents per kilowatt hour. And so the notion is, if you're out to save kilowatt hours, is it better to do it through conservation, or is it better to do it through a solar rebate program? You'll need to think about that as you get further into your deliberations. Lastly, we continue to evolve our CIP program, thinking in terms of behavior programs, more efficient technologies, and lastly, weatherization efforts. How can we make homes more efficient? I'll mention this in terms of weatherization. We're an electric utility, and most of the homes that we serve don't heat their homes electrically. They heat it with natural gas or propane. So when we put in insulation or new windows, we're not saving kilowatt hours for the most part. We're not heating those homes. And so weatherization programs are often a challenge for electric utilities. I'm going to move back to that slide. excuse me, there was a question that we were supposed to respond to in terms of carbon emissions. In terms of carbon emissions, we're somewhere around 1,700 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour that we produce. And boy, you know, that doesn't mean much to you unless you're really into this business. But I guess what you can take away from this is the trend. The trend is that it's going down. Our carbon intensity for the energy that we're producing is going down. And you might ask, well, why is it going down? Three reasons come to my mind. One is that we put in a dry fining technology at our largest power plant in North Dakota. Dry fining. We're taking the coal, and before it goes into the boiler, we're drying that coal, taking some of the moisture out of it. And the way we're drying that coal is we're taking some of the waste heat before it goes up the stack. We're taking that waste heat and bringing it back into the front end of the process and blasting that waste heat through the talcum powder consistency that the coal is at that point, and taking some of the moisture out of it, and we're able to produce more energy with less coal. A couple of other things in terms of the trend. We have about 150% more energy coming from renewables than we did in 2007. We're getting more wind energy in our portfolio. It's not any carbon intensity to that. The other thing we have is we have a lot more hydropower in our portfolio than we did in 2007. And that comes from Manitoba Hydro in an exchange agreement. So the density, the carbon density of our megawatt hours is becoming less over time. And the trend will be that it'll continue to do that. I'm going to go back to the slide I skipped. And I wanted to finish on this one. And that is that I've been in this business for nearly 40 years. And I'll have to tell you, it's in a challenging time, but it's an exciting time for the utility business and for the energy business. It's full of IT technology. It's full of energy efficiency technology. It's full of technology that's going to change our business. It's an exciting time. Demand-side management or demand response is something that Great River Energy has been doing for 30 years. It's the notion of getting our members to do something within their homes to reduce the demand for electricity. Cycle their air conditioners. Put these water heaters during the off-peak hours. All these programs that we have, and members participate. And I want to say it's because we're a co-op, and they like this notion that I can do something to help my co-op. The slide is showing that load curve. And the load curve, what it shows is the hours of the day. And Joe mentioned how in the wee hours of the night, our load goes right down into the toilet. We can't sell energy in the middle of the night. But then it comes up fairly fast in the morning. And the red line on this slide is basically showing how we can cut off the peak on a hot summer day. And we do that with these water heaters and cycled air conditioners and irrigation and all these customers that participate in our programs. Over 350,000 controlled loads, reducing our peak by somewhere around 13% to 14%. The DOE is now recognizing the value of demand response. You'll see it on the black and yellow labels on refrigerators and appliances soon. It's not only important to know how much your appliance uses, but now it's going to be important to know when it uses energy as well. Some of the other things that we're excited about are smart appliances, this notion that we can send a signal to a refrigerator and keep it from going into a defrost mode, or making ice cubes and making it more efficient. Smart pricing, this notion that eventually I think distribution co-ops are going to have prices that change throughout the day. Electric vehicles. We're really excited about electric vehicles when they come. And lastly, this notion of electric storage. With that, Madam Chair, I'll end my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions from members? If not, I know that the folks at GRE are welcoming to members who might want to go out and see their Maple Grove facility. They have a LEED Platinum headquarters. And there's a lot that you can learn just touring the building and meeting with people there. So thank you very much for that open door policy. Next, we're going to move to the Pollution Control Agency is going to do an overview on some of the emissions from the Minnesota's energy sector. When I met with folks before the session started, and I'm sure when all of you met with utilities and started thinking about energy issues before the session started, you also heard a lot about EPA regulations. And in the media today, we hear a lot about EPA regulations. And so we asked the Pollution Control Agency to address the issue of impending EPA regulations and what impact that's having on on potential future generation from coal power plants that we're hearing about. So thank you for coming. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Catherine Neuschler. I'm the legislative coordinator at the Pollution Control Agency. And so today I'm actually going to start with a some basic information about the emissions of air pollutants from Minnesota's energy sector, focusing on electric utilities, and then move on to provide some of that information about the future EPA regulations. In general, this just kind of gives an overall picture of air emissions in Minnesota, and it looks pretty good. Since 1990, we've seen increases in our key measures of economic growth and development, such as gross state product, energy consumption, and population, but a corresponding decrease in some of our key traditional air pollutants. And in addition, although we've seen increases in greenhouse gas emissions, the growth has been at a lesser rate than our measures of economic growth. In terms of focusing on the energy picture, I'm going to focus today on four key pollutants, and those include nitrogen oxides, or NOx, sulfur dioxide, or SO2, greenhouse gases, and mercury. Although power plants also emit other pollutants of concern, they're main contributors to these four pollutants. Of the sort of traditional air pollutants, I'm going to focus on nitrogen oxides and SO2 because of their contribution, their importance both in and of themselves and their contribution to ozone and to fine particles, which are other air pollutants that we're concerned about at the PCA but that we're not looking at specifically in this presentation. Just to give you a general picture of sort of the overall status of these emissions, of our nitrogen oxide emissions, we would consider electric utilities part of the point source category, which is only 29% of the total, and then the electric utilities are 15% of that 29% total. So once you pull it out, it's not quite as big, perhaps. But electric utilities are a much bigger contributor to our SO2 or sulfur dioxide emissions. In that case, point sources are a major contributor, and electric utilities are a large part of that, being 70% of that point source total. If we break it down by fuel, looking at the emissions of these two pollutants from power plants, they are vastly majority coal, with some, particularly for the NOx, the nitrogen oxide emissions, some natural gas contributions, but the vast majority of it is coal. Pollutant emissions from Minnesota's power plants have decreased in recent years. This graph goes back to 2000. The most dramatic decrease, again, is in these two traditional air pollutants that we're looking at, the nitrogen oxides and the SO2, but we've also seen some decreases in greenhouse gas emissions, especially in recent years. We've also seen reductions in mercury emissions from power plants. This is the red bar on this graph. The mercury emissions from power plants, again, come primarily from burning coal. And we've seen decreases between 2005 and 2008 and are projecting projecting decreases into the future as our utilities work to help us meet a statewide goal of having annual mercury emissions of 789 pounds by 2025, compared to almost 3,500 pounds in 2005. The next two slides I'm going to go up a little further to the bigger energy picture, not focused just on electric utility, but looking at all production and consumption of energy. It is primarily from electricity generation and transportation, but also includes some space heating and some other types of energy. So this breaks down our overall greenhouse gas emissions from that overall energy use by the fuel that is used to generate them. And the big ones are petroleum, coal, and natural gas. And then if you look at the purple, it actually separately breaks out our electricity imports, so the energy from that we import into Minnesota as opposed to what's generated within the state. Again, looking at greenhouse gas emissions from the whole energy use, we look at by sector. And here, again, you can see that electric generation is a big piece. It's 40% of the total. Transportation in the blue is 30%. And the top, the green, is industrial use, is about 14%. And again, these include only direct emissions from fuel combustion processes. So that's kind of the general picture of emissions, because a quick overview. and was hoping that we could focus a little more on the EPA rules that we expect to have impacting the electric power plants over the next couple of years. And this has the name and sort of the regulatory status. The first is the revised cooling water intake rule, which is designed to protect fish from getting stuck in the cooling water intakes at existing power plants. And EPA is required to finalize that action by June of 2013. The second is the coal combustion residuals rule, which basically relates to coal ash, which EPA really started to think about after the Tennessee Valley Authority's Kingston, Tennessee plant released 1.1 billion gallons of coal ash slurry. So EPA has proposed a possible two options for regulating this coal ash. The first would be to regulate it as a hazardous waste, and the second option would be to regulate it as a solid waste, which is state responsibility. And although EPA proposed these in June 2010, at this point we don't know when they may finalize those rules. They don't have a schedule at this time. The third one is the Greenhouse Gas New Source Performance Standards, which would be the first establishment of carbon dioxide emission standards that would apply to new and to reconstructed power plants. And it would require those, as proposed, it would require the plants to meet carbon dioxide limits equivalent to that of a natural gas combined cycle turbine, which is pretty much the lowest of the currently operating types of technologies. It doesn't apply to plants that start construction within 12 months of the proposal, so those that start construction between April 2012 and April 2013. And it applies only to fossil fuel fired plants. EPA is projecting that they will finalize this rule very soon, March of 2013. The next one is rules for regional haze and visibility. And these are rules that EPA has proposed as part of their regional haze program. It requires the states to evaluate older power plants, those built between 1962 and 1977, to see if they can be retrofit to reduce their sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, and particle emissions. And that gets somewhat tied up with the next rule, which is called the Cross-State Air Pollution Rule, sometimes referred to as CSAPR or CSAP or something else, depending on how we've all decided to pronounce our acronyms that day. This is a cap-and-trade system for nitrogen oxide and sulfur dioxide emissions for power plants in the eastern half of the United States. It's designed to help those states meet federal standards for ozone and fine particles, which, as I noted earlier, nitrogen oxide and SO2 emissions contribute to the formation of those. It's actually EPA's second attempt to do this kind of program. They originally proposed something called the Clean Air Interstate Rule, which was thrown out by the courts originally, but then put back and is currently in place while EPA developed this replacement. The replacement was adopted in August 2011, but was again vacated by the courts in 2012. And EPA's request for a rehearing of that was just denied, and so there's a lot of regulatory limbo surrounding this idea of a cap-and-trade program for nitrogen oxides and SO2 in the eastern part of the U.S. The interesting thing for Minnesota is that the first version of this rule is still in place. Minnesota is not included in that. The second version of this rule, which has not been finalized, Minnesota would have been included, so it puts our power plants in sort of an interesting position of trying to figure out whether they're in or out. And there could still be more legal action on that. The last one on this slide is the Mercury and Air Toxics Standard, also called MATS. This was adopted in February 2012. It applies to both new and existing power plants for regulation of mercury primarily, but also particles, acid gases, including those that have sulfur components, and metals. And facilities that are subject to this get 3 years after the promulgation to comply with the rule, with a fourth year if necessary for them to complete the actions that they need to take for compliance. And the last two that we know that EPA is thinking about are revised effluent limitation guidelines on the water side. This says to be proposed December 2012. I didn't check on it, but my guess is, since we didn't update that, that EPA missed that deadline. And at some point, they are planning to do greenhouse gas emission guidelines for existing plants to counter or to work with the new source performance standards for new sources. But those are not yet scheduled. So that's a lot coming. A lot of it's been on the table for a while, but there's still a lot there. In general, however, we do think that Minnesota's electric utilities are well prepared for the air pollution portion of the rules anyway. I'm not as familiar with the other pieces. Since 2002, we've had some large emission reduction projects. Xcel's Metropolitan Emission Reduction Project, Minnesota Power's Arrowhead Regional Emissions Abatement Project. And in addition, Minnesota's Mercury Reduction Act of 2006 asked Minnesota's six largest coal-fired boilers to undertake mercury reduction by 2014 and to look at multi-pollutant strategies that would help them reduce not just mercury but other pollutants as well. So with those plans being developed and implemented, and with the preparations for the cap and trade programs that are in limbo, what we've seen is that we feel that our power plants are in good shape to meet the federal requirements, at least on the air pollution side. And that is a pretty quick summary there, but that's what I have, and I'm happy to take questions at this time.
I have some questions. Representative Beard, I'd like to go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, I'm pretty familiar, and the committee will be familiar, too, with all of these on page number 6 on the air, climate, water requirements that EPA is coming out with. The one that puzzles me, though, is this regional haze rule. I mean, for crying out loud, who dreamed up 130 miles? What human being is capable of seeing that far, and why did the EPA stray from human health into what appears to me to be aesthetics? Is there some rationale behind that that I missed?
Ms. Neuschler?
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Beard. It is actually, the regional haze rules are based on Section 169A, I believe, of the Clean Air Act. And I believe there's also language in Section 169B where EPA, or Congress actually set forth a national goal of improving visibility in our national parks and wildernesses. So that's why EPA did those rules, was to implement that congressional intent. And in terms of power plants, the states have to specifically look at the power plants built and other sources built within 1962 and 1977. And I think generally the idea was to take a look at plants that hadn't been looked at under other Clean Air Act requirements and see if there were feasible and cost-effective technologies to reduce emissions.
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, the feasible cost-effective technologies is one I know that we're getting hung up on, too, and I think that's what Texas sued over, if I'm not mistaken. Best available technology versus maximum available technology. Maybe it'd be helpful for the committee if the testifier could just touch briefly on those so we kind of know what we're up against.
Ms. Neuschler.
Madam Chair, I will, and members of the committee, I will do my best. I'm not familiar with the Texas regulation. There are a lot of acronyms in the Clean Air Act. One of them is maximum achievable control technology, which is what the mercury and air toxics rule relies on. We use that term for toxics rules. Then there are two terms, best available control technology and best available retrofit technology. And best available control technology is generally done during a permitting process when a facility is expanding. And it's generally a more stringent level of control than best available retrofit technology, which is something that was created specifically for regional haze to look at older plants that weren't necessarily changing. So it does get confusing because there's a lot of different possible kinds of technology and levels of stringency that EPA puts in there.
Other questions before the chair's questions? Okay. Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at your projected goals for mercury emissions, so that is just airborne. Do you have goals for total mercury introduced into the environment And your target for 2025, well, actually, the target for 2018, even if we used just three of the compact fluorescent bulbs with 5 milligrams of mercury per each per person in a year, that we would then have more mercury going into the environment from the bulbs than we would from the coal. Have you, done any analysis on this? Do you have a total, or you only analyze what goes into the air?
Representative Quam, actually, Mr. Evans and I did some calculations back in 2005, 2006 about fluorescent light bulbs and mercury when the legislature was looking at the Mercury Emissions Reduction Act of 2006. I don't know if Ms. Neuschler has looked at the comparative numbers on fluorescent light bulbs versus emissions saved.
Madam Chair, I don't know that. I do. One of the parts of this bar is of what we're trying to reduce is the purposeful use of mercury. So that's mercury in products. And my guess is that the light bulb usage would be in that portion.
Representative Quam, if I remember right, Mr. Evans and I calculated that even if you smashed all of those fluorescent light bulbs that we're encouraging people to use instead of properly recycling them, that we would still have less mercury in the environment as a result of people using them and demanding less electricity from a mostly coal-fired profile that we have in Minnesota. I think there's math on it. I don't know who has the math on it. But
Madam Chair.
Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, thank you. Being a humble physicist and looking at the decrease, I see the transition being comparable in about 2015 because of the taking coal offline. But that's using 5 milligrams per bulb and,
way less than
an estimate. Well, actually from, Popular Mechanics and other independent groups that have looked at the quantity. We can look at this in the future. It's just that if we're taking care of the mercury issue from the coal plants, which is a good thing to do, then we should also be, if it's the same order of magnitude, giving attention to the issue that is before us, because Minnesota, the bulbs do not last the amount of time that the advertising says they do. Therefore, the projected recycle rate and et cetera is off. So at some time offline, we may have a discussion over coffee.
That's a good idea, Representative Quam. I think I've introduced about 8 bills on recycling fluorescent light bulbs, so you'd be a good partner for me in that enterprise. One interesting note about mercury pollution is that about 3% of the state's emissions come from crematoria because we don't let morticians take out people's teeth. We only let dentists do that. So we can talk about tackling that interesting topic as well, Representative Quam. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, as long as we're talking about coal, and I know we're seeing a lot of the ads for clean coal, just exactly what is that and how much impact does it have on these coal-fired boilers, for instance, that you've got mentioned here?
Ms. Neuschler.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't have that information as to whether any of our utilities are using clean coal technologies or what they're using. So we can work on that and get back to you.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Mason, any others?
Work on that and get back to you.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Mason, any others? I had a question from one of your pie charts, the NOx pie chart, Minnesota NOx emissions by source category. There's 42% of our emissions, it comes from on-road, mm-hmm. and 29% point, and then 25% non-road. Can you tell me what in that red slice of the pie, what is that 25%? What's the category non-road include?
Madam Chair, the non-road would be tend to be mobile things that don't go on highways. So construction equipment and things like that.
Farm equipment, ships, railroads, that type of thing.
Madam Chair, I believe that is correct, but I'm not 100% sure on that, so we'll have to check that.
And then I had just two other questions. On your greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota from energy used by fuel, you have a pretty big chunk. The red line is natural gas. In my understanding, when natural gas combusts, it has no greenhouse gas emissions. So is that entire chunk of the natural gas greenhouse gas emissions leakage, or do you know if there are some byproducts from emission? Ms. Neuschler.
Madam Chair, natural gas does, in combustion, does produce greenhouse gas emissions. It's just considerably less than coal.
Just a follow-up, do you know what proportion is leakage to combustion, or?
Madam Chair, I do not know. I know that this graph does include natural gas transmission. I don't know if we have the quantification for leakage, but we will check on that.
Thanks. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. She already answered what I was going to put, mostly that anytime you're burning anything other than just hydrogen that contain, anything that's carbon containing, you're going to get CO2. So as she mentioned, the natural gas produces less for the amount of energy you get out of it, but it's mostly cleaner because it has less other stuff in it compared to coal.
I had one more question then, if nobody else did. With regard to the cap and trade for SOx and NOx, with the Clean Air Interstate Rule being tied up in litigation, even though it's been tied up in litigation since it started, hasn't the cap and trade for SOx and NOx been very effective at reducing the nation's sulfur dioxide and nitrogen dioxide emissions?
Madam Chair, certainly for sulfur dioxide, we've had a trading program covering the entire U.S. since 1990 under Title IV to reduce acid rain, and it has been considered one of the more successful of our of those kind of policies, of a market-based policy for reducing emissions. In terms of how, although the market for the cleaner interstate rule is operating in most of the states, because that program is still in effect, I think the regulatory uncertainty around it has probably been an impact, and I'm not sure how well that's been working in emission reductions.
Any other questions? I'm sure that the utilities have entire departments of people who spend time looking at this list that you put on the last two pages of the proposed EPA rules, and I know there's a lot of uncertainty and coming information, so hopefully as that becomes more clear, both the Pollution Control Agency and the utilities can share with us the impacts it's having on your business. And if there's no other questions, the Energy Policy Committee is adjourned.